This is Listening to the Dead.
Uncovering the secrets of forensics today.
I'm Linda LaPlante, novelist, producer, writer of 150 hours of TV and 33 crime novels. And truthfully, I don't think one could have been completed without the assistance of the police, especially my close friend Cass Sutherland.
Hi, I'm Cass Sutherland, former detective and CSI in the Metropolitan Police Force. I was a detective and CSI for over 30 years, and I learnt a lot during my service. But I've learned even more since I've retired, particularly through my research work and being a member of the Chartered Society of Forensic Sciences. Forensic science is continually evolving, and that's one of the reasons why Linda and I are doing this podcast, to help you to appreciate what science can and cannot do, and to have a better understanding of it.
This is episode one, Forensic Botany and Ecology.
Linda, we've been working together now since, I think, the late 1990s when you got me on board because of my experience as a CSI. And I think in some of the cases we've done over the years, we've used forensic ecology. Can you remember some of the cases that we used?
We did actually do two. One was poison ivy, and the other was the growth of a very natural flower in a garden that could proved to be absolutely deadly. But what was interesting was that, you know, to get the authority to have a look at what we were doing, because they specifically said, this is how long it would last, this is how deadly it was. And so I wrote to accommodate the scientific information. And then you would oversee the police procedure.
I remember those incidents because forensic ecology was something to me that was something I knew about, but I had to access other people. And in this particular case, I think it was a lady called Patricia Wiltshire, who's a forensic ecologist, who I think you may have met at one of the forensic science conferences and spoken to her there.
Yes, she's quite brilliant because it is their specific area that is so fascinating. And if you think that because of their knowledge and the evidence they can get, one leaf, and they can trace where that leaf came from, and the number of cases they have been able to literally crack open by specifically saying, this leaf would have curled in this way, it had taken so much time, and therefore it had to have come locally. And then the police would search and bingo, they'd find a garden with a lupus tree that was extraordinary.
Yes, because you can have like a body that's been buried or dumped in, for example, woodland, and actually need a number of different forensic experts. You obviously have the ecologist for the plants, and then you might need an archaeologist to help you dig the body to get it out of the ground in the best way to preserve evidence. And then there's obviously the expert on the flies and the larva that might be on the body. Interestingly as well, that Patricia Wiltshire, you mentioned there about plants and things, worked on the Soham case.
Oh, really?
With the two young girls, yeah, at RAF Lakenheath, where they'd been dumped in some woodland. And she used the stinging nettles, realising where they'd been broken and how he'd gone in there, and was able to tell how long ago he must have put the bodies there because of the damage and the regrowth to the stinging nettles, which is similar, very similar to what you described.
That case, I think, is stamped in virtually everyone's memory. You will never forget those two beautiful children. And due to my research and contacts, I was actually at the trial. And as a dramatist and a writer of crime novels, to be present to see that despicable killer on the stand being questioned and lying, but at the same time in court one saw the impact of excruciating pain, because the parents of both child were in court listening to the trial, and then at almost arm's length away from them was the girlfriend of the killer, and she had a particular nervous, she twitched and she turned, because she could almost feel, as everyone in that court felt, those x-rays of actual anguish coming as these parents learnt fact after fact, and the guilt that spirals out of a case like that, to even down to why did they not at that school when they hired him as a caretaker check out his background. And it's qualities like that for me as a writer that really are so important that I get things right. And for example, at that trial, it was the first time I ever saw a jury use screens. And they all had screens in front of them. So describing, as we've just talked about, you know, how the bodies were found, where they were found, and how somebody like Pam could come in and give vital information.
The Soham case came up in my interview with Pat Wilshire. So let's hear what she has to say about her experiences in that case, among other things. I remember when I first discovered Patricia Wiltshire, the Pollen Lady, as she was known. I was a CSI at the time on the murder squad in London, and I attended a lecture you gave, and I realised how invaluable your discipline could be to not just murder investigation, but a wealth of serious crime investigations. Can we talk about how this science, or your particular science, evolved, and when you were first called upon by the police?
Well, you're talking specifically, Callum, about palynology, which is the study of pollen, spores, fungal spores, any microscopic entity that ends up on a microscope slide. I like to think of myself as being an ecologist, which looks at just about everything. You have to just, you know, have to know a bit about, well, certainly a lot about soils, botany, zoology, mycology, statistics, you name it. My great love is bacteria and fungi. Anyway, I ended up working in pollen, and I eventually ended up at University College London in the Institute of Archaeology, and I was responsible for environmental reconstruction of archaeological sites. And one day I got a telephone call from Hertfordshire Constabulary, and they said, Kew Gardens have given us your name. They can't help us, but they said you could. And it was a murder case, and that's what started it off.
Ah, very interesting. When you arrive at the scene, how do you work that scene?
Well, when I arrive, usually the police have set up their cordons. They've got the outer cordon, and then they've got their inner cordon. And one of the first things I'm asked is, can you give us the approach path? Which way into the scene did the offender approach? So I say, right, don't move, don't do anything. And then I spend quite a lot of time just looking and looking and moving around incredibly carefully. And sometimes I can see paths and other people can't see them, but I can see where people have been. I can tell very often how long ago that someone walked there. Why? Because if you tread on a plant, a lot of them will recover. And you get a curvature in the stem. How long does it take for that curvature to form? Measure the curvature, and you can vary up with the angle, and you can do little experiments, and you can work out roughly. I did this with a whole load of thistles in Wales once, where some murderers had gone down a bank. They'd trodden on the thistles. Other things, the palynology showed me that they'd gone back up and back down again. But I could work out how long ago it had happened by the fact that the thistles had recovered. And the angle of curvature gave me an idea of how long it took. And this is what you can get from a crime scene if nobody goes in with their size 10s. before I do. I then have to get a picture of place from the shoes, clothes, car, whatever I'm given. And very often it's only partial, because if you go to a place, invariably you pick up only part of it. If you think about a jigsaw puzzle, if you've got enough pieces, even if there are wrong pieces in it or there are gaps, you can still see the picture. You can. And if you have something that's quite unusual in that picture, that makes it much more distinctive. So if I get that assemblage, that picture on, say, someone's shoe, with that something special, what's the chances of getting exactly that somewhere else? I have to eliminate other places. But invariably, because everything is so unique, every place is so unique, you can often put people, you can say this person is highly likely to have been to this place. Of course, you go to court. And the first thing the barrister on the other side will say is, oh, but you can get that assemblage anywhere. So you then work on all the alibi sites. The defendant might say, oh, well, I've been here walking my dog and I go fishing there and I do this and I do that. Right. I go to all those places.
And test them.
Yes, and test them. In another case, and it is the very famous Soham case, Huntley had walked into the scene and the police couldn't work out. How did he get in? The nettles are chest high. But when I walked down the path, I could see that there were two areas that had been disturbed. And one, the grasses and some other plants, and particularly stinging nettles, had been trodden down, had recovered. So the holes, if you like, had recovered. But when I picked the nettles and brought them out, the plant had responded in its typical way. If you take the tip off a lot of plants or you tread on the tip, you break the stream of hormones from that tip down to the rest of the plant. Without that hormonal control, all the little side shoots become main shoots. Mm. And up they go. And they will grow just as though they were the main shoots. And by estimating how long it took them to do that, you can work how long
from
ago.
From when they became
that's
damaged.
That's right. Yeah. And that's, in fact, in the Soham case, I told the police, well, I think it's about 2 weeks. The entomologist actually said 4 days, but the plant said 2 weeks. And then, of course, one has to find out what plants are there. Because if a plant is there and it produces pollen, its pollen will be there. It'll be present on its own leaves. It'll be present on the soil. And even if it's a plant that doesn't produce much pollen because it's insect pollinated, when it dies, its pollen gets in the soil. So if anyone touches the plant, treads on the plant, or the soil where the plant has been, all those pollen grains, lots of those pollen grains and mixtures of them will be transferred to the person. And they can't shake them off. They can't get rid of them. So I can then say, this assemblage of plants is at the crime scene.
Let's imagine, for example, a shoe or a piece of clothing, and you'll be looking for the different pollens and things around. At the same time, there may be blood, saliva, DNA on that clothing that may be important, and obviously fibres. Because the fibre expert will want to tape for the fibres. Are you able to work together? What order would you...
Well,
is most preferable for you?
My techniques are destructive. So I always say to everybody, you do your thing, give me what's left over. The only thing that worries me slightly is the fibres, because if they press very heavily, they're going to go into the weave of the fabric and bring out the pollen. If they do it very lightly, it doesn't matter, because the fibres are always on the surface. So I say, right, do your DNA, do your this, do your fibres, do whatever you like. Give me the garment because, and I've seen this under the microscope, once a pollen grain lands on a fabric, it becomes alive and it wiggles and wiggles and wiggles right down into the weave. This is because it's a charged particle and the charges in the fabric attract it. And so it's difficult to get out. So I never worry. I never worry. Just give it to me so I can chop it up and do my thing with it, you know. And it works quite well.
Have you ever had, as a side to that, a case where, for example, somebody's been on a flight and come back from somewhere in Malaysia or something, and then they've got home and they've been murdered, and you found pollens and somebody, you think, these aren't even from this country. Have you ever had a case like that?
Well, I've certainly had cases like that. I had one where there was a murdered baby in Ireland. A little body had been found in a hedge, and the police thought she'd been buried in soil before she'd been put in the bag and thrown in the hedge. Well, I went to the mortuary, and when I looked at it, I said, this is Pete. This is actual Pete. And it looked as though this newborn baby with stabbed wounds, this baby has probably been in a bag of peat of some sort. So Northern Ireland is a bit sensitive. So I was tasked with going around the garden centres, because when I actually looked at the peat on the baby, I analysed it. I knew it was blanket peat. This is the peat that covers the Pennines, covers Ireland, covers Wales. It blankets the landscape. We call it blanket peat. I knew it was blanket peat, but it wasn't British. It just wasn't right. So I went round the garden centres and I said, oh, I'm a British botanist and I'm very interested in peat. And I was wondering where you got your peat from. This says it's Irish moss peat. Oh, yes, no, he says, but a lot of the peat comes from Estonia and Russia. I said, really? Well, yes, we're not really supposed to dig up our Irish peat. He said, this comes from Estonia in Russia. So I had identified blanket peat. So I could say, probably, this is horticultural peat. This has got to be present in someone's garden, in a hanging basket or a pot or something. Find that pot and we'll be able to find the culprit, because it's very specific.
What about cold cases? Do you get called in much on old cold cases?
Oh,
and,
yes.
And hoping that the evidence still exists?
Well, it does, you see, because pollen, you can't get rid of pollen. It stays in the fabric, and it doesn't decompose away if the fabric is kept dry. And I did a case of a little murdered boy. He'd been dumped in a canal. And in 1983, and I was called in the 2000s, a forensic geologist had looked at it and the police didn't believe his answers. I worked on that case for 5 years. I had to put it all back together again because the geologist fractionated all the samples. I put it all back together again. And there were, I think, 4 or 5 suspects, and I went to their homes, I took samples, and don't forget, this was a long time ago, but they had a stone that had been used to weigh the child down, and the stone hadn't really come in contact with the water. And lo and behold, I got a profile of a garden from this stone. And when the police gave me the child's clothes, I could say, I could give them a lot of information. I'm not going to talk about it because it's too distressing. But it was obvious to me that the child had been on the ground in this garden and there was cereal pollen. Now, how do you get cereal pollen in a garden? So I thought, oh, I wonder if he kept chickens. So the police went back and asked neighbours, did this person keep chickens? Oh, no, but he kept ducks. And the profile was very, very convincing, and it turned out to be a member of the family, and he was already in prison for other offences, and the police knew it was him, but they couldn't prove it. So I, quite innocently, completely blind, had picked on this garden, and the police had convinced that he was guilty, but he had died in prison the year before. But what that did mean was all the other suspects were released from suspicion, which is a good thing. Yes.
Pat, it's been very interesting and it's been a pleasure, but I'd like to ask you one personal question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like gardening? And if not, is it because you don't like to mix business with pleasure?
I love gardening, but only supervising.
Thank you very much, Pat. It's been very enjoyable.
Well, I think Patricia is a very special person. What it throws up, and which I think is really interesting, is that all the new forensic knowledge is only useful if someone has trained the police to know about it and how it might be applied to certain crime scenes. Otherwise, how will they ever know to call these experts in? What do you think, Cass?
I agree with you 100%. It also, if you understand the science or the workings of it, it allows you to challenge the expert. I found one of the problems was that sometimes some experts say things that aren't actually evidence, but it's because they don't understand that, no, you can't, that's an opinion with nothing to back it up. But I found if you understood their discipline to an extent, you could ask them the right questions in the context of your investigation, and it would enable you to understand what they're saying as well. And I think that would be very, very beneficial to police investigators.
Yeah. It's like pollen. Pollen left on a body can actually become alive and weave its way into the fabric. To me, I had no idea that that could happen. Have you ever come across a case where that was used?
I've had cases where pollen has been used to help, where body, particularly useful where bodies have been moved, and you'll find a source of pollen on the body. And somebody like Pat is able to say, well, that pollen should, because there's nothing around here that creates that pollen. This body must have been somewhere else before it was deposited here. And there's been cases where a body was wrapped in a carpet, put in a garden, recovered in woodland, still in the carpet. The carpet is examined. And it was actually Pat Wiltshire was taken to this suspect's garden. And she went, over there in the corner. Right away, because of the plants in that corner, she knew was the abundance of foreign pollens that were on where it was found in the woodland. And she was right. One of my thoughts about it, though, is if I've murdered somebody and I brush against you, how many of those pollens do I put on you? And if you become a suspect, you've never actually been to that scene, but you could have the pollens on. So it's dependent as well on...
Is that what they call about transference?
Yeah, cross-contamination.
Cross-contamination. Yeah. Because I've used that a lot, that, you know, somebody can be touched, as you said, by shaking a hand, and somebody, the killer, has actually used swipe pollen, shakes your hand, you then carry it. And so that, to actually ascertain, then it becomes very complicated. And over again, evidence has been thrown out of court and murder trials because of cross-contamination, and which is why it has to be so careful. And the bagging of evidence has to be predominantly perfectly done. Otherwise, you have contamination over touching it. And the use of gloves now. I mean, this is only, I would say, in the past even 10 years where it is compulsory to put on the gloves. You mean, before that, they were shoving things in, you know, caught on their raincoat, you know, that the police were shedding fabric, never mind collecting it. And I think, now that awareness, and it's like, you know, a body to be able to get somebody like Patricia in to say, this body was dragged across this amount of land because by looking at the plants and the way the grass has been moved, you can see the signs where the body was dropped, picked up again. And it's all the signs. It is rather like a kind of game that begins when the call comes in and says, we need you to have a look at our murder site.
Well, I think teaching CSIs and detectives, to an extent, are kind of like basic things to do. If they understood those things, you know, if you're at a scene and there is grass, get down on your stomach, lie on the ground and look at the grass, because standing up, you might not see it, because you need to plan a route to the body that the suspect hasn't gone through or taken it that way and come in from a different way. And that's where evidence gets damaged. They see the body in the wood, they go straight to it. step back. If somebody's dead, they're not going anywhere. Step back, have a look around you. Say, right, I'm going to come in from the other end. I've had a case where I've gone up in a helicopter in a small bit of woodland so I can see exactly what I need to see. Unfortunately, somebody let the dogs in before we went in to get to the body, and there was plastic bags with bits of body that they ripped open. Yes, mistakes happen, but they don't need to happen if you communicate with each other and you know what you're doing and how best to do it.
Because, you know, recently I've been working on bringing Jane Tennyson through the years of her early career until she reached the age that Helen Mirren portrayed her. And so I'm around about 1982 now, and big murder happens, a bloodbath, and I've written away and I've put duckboards down. And I've said that the forensic expert came in and he said, put your duckboards down, there's a lot of footprints in the carpet, in the blood. Now, duckboards are, you know, the wooden platforms that when there's a big bloodbath of murder footprints, they put these wooden slats over them to protect the footmarks. Whereas that didn't come in till mid-80s?
Yeah, or later. I mean, you used to improvise at crime scenes. I remember one in a pub thing, and we just used the beer crates to put all the bottles in so we could take them away. We didn't have individual packaging. Now there's specialist packaging for knives, guns. There just wasn't those sorts. And it wasn't uncommon to, you know, during a post-mortem for somebody to be smoking.
I was very moved that Patricia, even in the aftermath, found it exceedingly difficult to talk about the little boy's death. And in all honesty, I only have ever written one child murder because it is exceedingly difficult to deal with, and for the police to be the ones to say, your little girl isn't missing, I'm afraid we found her. It sends chills down you. And I had written the first case in the first trial and retribution about a child murder missing. And it was so emotionally traumatic to do the research. But what I found very, very upsetting was that we actually had twins, the tiny child. And what was astonishingly upsetting was the actors and the autopsy where the child, obviously she was so young, she was a little three-year-old, didn't know, that she thought it was a game. But it affected the actors very deeply, the camera crew. It was something that I made a point of never, ever writing another child murder because I think it's double-fold, truthfully. There are two emotions that, A, the pain is horrendous, but it's also dramatically, and I find this quite difficult to say, but I think it's a cheap way of bringing a reader, audience, listener in, because no one wants to know about a child. No one wants to know that. And seeing the effect that had on me, I really understand Patricia. And emotionally, I never, ever will do another crime around a child.
From personal experience, I agree with you totally. I also found that if you were dealing with a child, it hit home even harder if they were about the same age as your own children. But at the time, because you're doing a job, your mind's set on, where can I find the evidence? What can I find to find whoever's done this? So it doesn't really affect you so much at the time, but it might be that night, it might be the next day, it might be a week later, it might be months later, but it does. If you want to know more about this subject, then I thoroughly recommend Patricia Wiltshire's new book, Traces, which is out now in all formats.
Our next episode is out next week and we'll be on fire investigation with one of the world's leading experts. Here's a clip.
We thought it was an arsonist at work at first, because if you look at the different flats that are on fire, it actually looks like you've got the main fire from the ninth floor up, but then we've got this fire on the fifth floor and the seventh floor. And this is where burning material fell out of the building, and the wind was blowing against the building that day, and it actually blew bits of material back into the flats and caused these other fires.
Listening to the Dead is made in collaboration with Bonnier Books. Our producer is Chris Attaway. You can subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening now, and a new episode will pop up in your feed every week. Until then, thanks for listening.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Listening to the Dead. My new novel, Buried, is out April 2nd, 2020, in hardback, ebook, and audiobook.